Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Tuesday, August 22nd, 2023. South Sudan's national basketball team is warming up to face Puerto Rico in the FIBA Basketball World Cup tournament.
You know, as the tournament progresses from one level to another, as all teams do, you get to add more experienced players, you get to add some of the best players that you didn't have previously.
And some residents of North Darfur State received food aid after weeks of heavy fighting in the area.
Both sides are claiming victory. The Sudan Armed Forces are claiming that they have repulsed the attack yesterday. And the rocket support forces are claiming that they have dislodged SAF forces.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Intense clashes have erupted within the confines of the Armored Vehicles Corps of Sudan Armed Forces in Khartoum, a key military stronghold that houses the Tank Battalion and Mechanized Infantry Brigades. The paramilitary Rapid Support Forces claim control over the base, but the Sudan Armed Forces refutes the claim, saying its forces successfully repulsed the attack. My colleague Nabil Biagio spoke with Majak Dagot, a former deputy chief of Sudan's intelligence and former deputy minister of defense in independent South Sudan, about the significance of the fighting in Khartoum and its implications for South Sudan.
Armored Corps headquarters in Khartoum is the most important trophy of this contest going on between the Sudan Armed Forces and then the Rapid Support Forces. Whichever side that takes control of it, of course, would eventually determine the final outcome of the battle for Khartoum. As to the facts on the ground, this is still very foggy. Both sides are claiming victory. The Sudan Armed Forces are claiming that they have repulsed the attack yesterday. And the Rapid Support Forces are claiming that they have dislodged SAF forces from all the areas around the base. So there are no independent records as to which side really control which side of the base, or has the side fallen really to RSF or not.
You have close knowledge of Sudan's security forces, as you served as deputy chief of Sudanese intelligence when Sudan and South Sudan were one country. And you recently authored a paper on the situation in Sudan. How do you see the balance of military power between SAF, that's the army, and the paramilitaries of the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces?
Well, the fighting has been going on now for close to 4 months or so, and it can be argued that most of the essential capabilities of both sides have been worn out or affected by this continuous combat. You can see that even the Sudanese Air Forces has received some major blows, with jet fighters being shot down, armored personnel carriers and tanks being destroyed in the streets of Khartoum, and the same thing to the Rapid Support Forces. So it is difficult to measure the capabilities at this stage. But one thing is apparent: most of the bases of SAF inside Khartoum are under siege and are under attack from the RSF, which means it's likely that the RSF is holding the initiative, because it is the only side now on offensive for the past number of weeks. Much as the Sudan Armed Forces has attempted to go on offensive in a number of occasions, like twice in Al Bahri, these attempts have fizzled out. They have not succeeded. So basically, inside Khartoum, you can say to a certain degree, the RSF is having some upper hand, given the fact that they are holding to the initiative and they have held to it for this long. Elsewhere in Darfur, for example, that is really very difficult to gauge exactly as to which side is holding the upper hand. And in the other states of Sudan, I have not seen much fighting taking place.
And apart from serving in Sudan security, you also served as Deputy Minister of Defense in independent South Sudan. How do you see different scenarios in Sudan's conflict affecting South Sudan, Sudan, of course, being South Sudan's most important neighbor?
Well, the war in Sudan is already impacting very negatively on South Sudan. You can talk about the influx of refugees from Sudan. You can talk about the influx of South Sudanese refugees returning home. And the insecurity along the border, this is a very long, porous border. And there are no enough security forces manning border posts to stop some of the criminal activities that are now taking place along the border. You know, people coming with looted goods from Khartoum trying to smuggle them into South Sudan and all those kind of things. So this is already impacting very negatively on South Sudan. Of course, the issue of oil exportation through Sudan, through the pipeline that goes through Sudan to the marine terminal. This is a very risky and precarious operation now, and it depends on how this war is going to be resolved. If it protracts with no solution in sight, then you never know what's really going to happen to South Sudan oil being exported through Sudan.
That's Majak Dagot, former Deputy Chief of Sudan's Intelligence and former Deputy Defense Minister in South Sudan government. He spoke with my colleague Nabil Biagio this past hour from Juba. Still on Sudan, the international relations security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi says the fighting in Sudan is a complex issue with no easy solutions. The months-long armed conflict is worsening the country's dire humanitarian conditions, with millions of people scrambling for food and safety. For more insights, VOA's Paul Njiho spoke with Edgar Gitao, an international relations and security expert at the University in Nairobi, about what is next for Sudan.
Sudan is a country that has gone through very many coups from the time it got its independence. It got its coup in 1959, got coups many, many years coming down the road, up to the last coup that was the major coup in 89 that brought Omar al-Bashir into power. Now, Bashir came into power and realized very easily that the same way he came through the force of the gun, somebody else could overthrow him. So over the years, he created the RSF forces. There were the former Janjaweed militia that were operating in Darfur. But he elevated them to a quasi-military status, in what we call coup-proofing, just to ensure that he does not get kicked out of power. So the RSF was the counterbalance to the Sudan army under Burhan. So Bashir was able to use divide and rule between these two military leaders and keeping them in checks and balance to his own advantage. Right now, the biggest problem in Sudan is that the power struggle between Burhan and Dagalo is on who is going to play a more prominent role in either post civilian government or in the Sudan going forward. My analysis on the issue is that what is disturbing these two leaders is that they are not sure of the role they will play going forward in the governance of Sudan. If someone can assure them that their positions as two independent military leaders will not be touched, I have a feeling the situation will de-escalate and there'll be a greater chance of peace coming into Sudan. There's a lot of external interference in the Sudan conflict. It is a proxy war. We have Egypt inside there. We have the United Arab Emirates inside there. We have Russia inside there. We have Libya inside there. All these countries have different things that are at stake. For the Russians, the Wagner Group, it's a trade. It's a gold they deal with. The United Arab Emirates is their access to the port that they want built at Port Sudan. The Russians also want access to the port, to Port Sudan, because they want to build a big naval base. So we have all this. Egypt is worried that they want Burhan to remain in power because of the Ethiopian Dam, the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. So Sudan is one of those conflicts in Africa that has a lot of external influence.
That's an interesting angle that you bring in. When you look at the players who are already there, they're all there for a reason. And so how are they going to be kicked out? There's no army, no force that can literally go in there and try to stop these guys.
It's true. You're right. And that's in international relations, we usually say there is no global overacting power who can... We don't have any global police force that can arrest whoever is breaking the law. This needs to come. This is concerted effort. I believe, with or without the veto power, I believe the UN Security Council, taking up this matter seriously, can decide to pass very serious resolutions that can have far-reaching implications, especially on Libya, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates. Russia is a different ballgame. I understand they are a veto power, and they are a power. They are a great power in their own right. But at least let us start with all these other smaller regional interests. You know, tell them to back off. And once we get the external actors to back off, I believe Dagalo and Burhan might agree to see sense and de-escalate the situation and be able to sign a cessation of hostilities agreement and come, so they can come to a ceasefire.
That's Edgar Gitau, an international relations, security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi. He spoke with my colleague Paul Njiho from Nairobi. From war issues, let's go for some sports news. In few days, the FIBA Basketball World Cup will start, and the South Sudan national basketball team, the Bright Stars, will make their first appearance playing against Puerto Rico on Saturday. The Deputy Secretary General of the South Sudan Basketball Federation, as well as the FIBA Commissioner for South Sudan, is predicting victory for the Bright Stars team. For VOA News, Lucy Pony reports from Nairobi.
In February, the Bright Stars made history after hammering Senegal in the International Basketball Federation World Cup Africa qualifiers to secure a spot for the upcoming games. Aro Ramadan Chan is the Deputy Secretary General of the South Sudan Basketball Federation. He tells VOA the team is practicing and playing friendly tournaments in preparation for their international appearance. Aro says, as part of its preparations, the South Sudan team has had to make reinforcements, including adding NBA players Wenyeng Gabriel and Khalik Jones, and Marius Shayok and Emmanuel Akot, who have both played for the Canadian national team, and Mangok Mathiang, who has played for Australia.
You know, as the tournament progresses from one level to another, as all teams do, you get to add more experienced players. You get to add some of the best players that you didn't have previously. We did our level best to bring everybody on board to maintain that team that we had in the qualifiers. And then we added some of our big boys, some of our NBA boys, some of our pros who are playing out who couldn't come back then because of the commitments to different clubs, and they are in season.
Aro says head coach Royal Ivy will have his major callback, which includes Captain Kwan Kwan and Nuni Omot, Deng Akwoth and Mareng Gatkwoth, who played in the African qualifiers. And Aro says with the impossible task at hand, the team is ready and the players cannot wait to represent South Sudan.
Oh, the feeling is beautiful. The feeling is so positive. The boys are very excited. The boys are pumped up. The boys are ready to represent the flag. They're ready to represent our nation. And they can't wait for the day to come. They're very ready. Mentally, physically, psychologically, the boys are ready.
Optimism reigns in the South Sudan camp. And despite having to win in the group stages to move to the next stage, Aro believes the team will give its utmost best.
We're always hoping for the best, you know. And as we always say, we just go out there. We leave it out there. We leave it everything on the court so that by the time the last whistle goes, you know that you've given your best. You've given 100%, 110%, 120%. And then after that, the results will speak for themselves. Win or lose, our boys are going to give it their 100%. And we are just hoping for good results. But we have a good team.
Sande Dech is one of the players of the Bright Stars. He says last week's pre-World Cup friendlies helped the team gel together in preparations for tough matches ahead of them.
Obviously, being our first tournament, our hopes are to play one game at a time, put our best foot forward and you know, play that game and then lead on to the next one. And our hopes for the group is to finish as a top African team to qualify for the Olympics next year. You know, whether that's making it to the next round, to the third round, we don't know what that looks like. But at the moment, our process is just one game at a time. We're really looking forward to it. Once again, we're honoured, we're excited, and it's an opportunity to create history for our young country and you know, lay the foundation for the future generations.
Basketball fans in South Sudan say they are confident the Bright Stars will bring back a trophy. Supporter Agao Kothiakwany says she is waiting to see the Bright Stars perform in the World Cup matches.
This is the second historic event after South Sudan independence as the first country in East Africa to qualify for World Cup. We are so proud of our national team. We wish all the best. We are going to show the world that we are existing.
And Juba Town resident Kenyi Frederick predicts the Bright Stars will surprise the world.
All the best to our basketball national team. We look forward to celebrate your great victory in the next few weeks to come. It means a lot to us as the young people in the Republic of South Sudan. So we wish you all the best. God bless you.
The South Sudan Bright Stars only joined the International Basketball Federation in December 2013, 2 years after the country gained independence. The Bright Stars will make their global debut in the World Cup 2023 on August 26th. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony, reporting from Nairobi.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, ICRC says it has managed to distribute food to families in Darfur. Find out how after the break. Listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The International Committee of the Red Cross says access to people displaced by fighting in Darfur remains difficult amid ongoing fighting between Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces. ICRC spokesperson for Africa tells VOA's Nabil Biagio her office managed this week to deliver crucial aid to thousands of displaced individuals living in dire conditions within Al-Fashir, the capital of North Darfur state.
The humanitarian situation in Darfur is dire, and we are getting very worrying reports. The fighting is still ongoing and people fleeing their homes. There are many people who cross the border into the neighboring countries, but there are also those who are displaced within Sudan, within Darfur itself. So we are also see families who arrive in North Darfur, in and around the capital Al-Fashir, where we still have our national team, and they work very closely with the Sudanese Red Crescent Society. So this week they distributed assistance to some 9,000 displaced people. These people, when they fled their homes, they could not take anything with them, so they arrived with nothing but the clothes on their backs, and they live in extremely difficult conditions because we are now entering the rainy season. They are staying in makeshift camps in the scorching heat and under the pouring rain.
And Al-Fashir, where you say this week you were able to deliver aid to people fleeing violence in other parts of Darfur, like Niala, Al-Fashir was recently visited by this fighting. We got reports that both Al-Fashir in North Darfur and Al-Fula in West Kordofan were hit by clashes between the army and the paramilitaries. Tell me how these recent developments affected things.
And the security situation is very volatile all over Darfur. I think the situation is more stable in and around Al-Fashir, and this is the reason why this is the place that is on the receiving end, where people are fleeing to seek safety, and where our teams, together with the Sudanese Red Crescent Society volunteers, they could deliver this assistance, because in some places, where we are facing active fighting or extreme levels of insecurity. We don't have access to the civilian population, and it is a matter of a huge concern for us.
And how many people, how many displaced people do you estimate have fled and are now sheltering in Al-Fashir?
Well, this distribution, we managed to deliver assistance to 9,000 displaced people, but the situation is changing all the time. Like, people keep fleeing their homes, so as more and more people are crossing the borders, for example, into the neighboring Chad, so these numbers are constantly on the rise, and it is the same situation with people that are being displaced within Darfur itself. Like, these were the 9,000, these were the people that we registered and managed to assist this week. But this is not exhaustive, and the numbers keep rising, and the humanitarian situation is getting more and more difficult for them.
That's Liano Sienko, ICRC spokesperson for Africa. She was speaking with my colleague Nabil Biagio from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. The World Food Programme warns it will be forced to cut aid for hundreds of thousands of people suffering from acute hunger in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo because of funding for its humanitarian operation has dried up. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The Democratic Republic of Congo is home to the largest food crisis in the world. The United Nations reports political instability and armed conflicts have robbed millions of farmers of the ability to grow the food they need to be healthy. Currently, 25.8 million people in DRC are short of food. The World Food Programme reports more than a quarter of that population, some 6.7 million food insecure people, live in embattled Ituri, North Kivu, and South Kivu provinces. Of this number, the WFP country director in the DRC, Peter Musoka, on Tuesday said 1.5 million are in emergency levels of food insecurity, just one step away from famine. Speaking from the capital, Kinshasa, he says WFP's humanitarian operation is on life support and does not have enough money to feed all the people who do not have enough to eat.
In July alone, WFP managed to reach approximately 1.2 million people, but sadly, without additional funding, it's unlikely that we'll be able to reach even half of our intended target. The people of Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo need our immediate attention and support to prevent a full-scale humanitarian catastrophe.
Musoka says WFP requires $728 million for its operation in the eastern region. Unfortunately, he notes WFP faces a staggering funding gap of $567 million. The DRC faces a displacement as well as a hunger crisis. The United Nations reports about 6 million of the 6.3 million internally displaced people reside within the three eastern provinces. Conflicts involving anti-government militia groups have caused a series of interlinked crises, affecting people's access to clean water and shelter, health and education. It also has fueled gender-based violence, putting the lives of women and children at risk. UN Refugee Agency spokesperson Shabia Mantu says the severe food shortages in the region are driving women and girls to take greater risks to meet critical needs.
So the reports have been received of women and girls being sexually assaulted while collecting firewood and water. Some are forced to resort to harmful coping mechanisms, including transactional sex, and the food insecurity and lack of livelihood opportunities have also increased risks of exploitation and abuse of women and adolescent girls.
The World Food Programme says its humanitarian operation over the next 6 months hangs by a thread and is at a critical juncture. It says lives are at stake and the costs of inaction and lack of international support will be deadly. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
From Geneva, we move to Zimbabwe, where political parties are preparing for the country's general elections on Wednesday, with President Emmerson Mnangagwa and opposition leader Nelson Chamisa vying for votes for the presidency. For VOA News, Columbus Mavunga has the story from Harare, Zimbabwe.
Zimbabweans are getting ready to choose their leaders in the country's general election on Wednesday. Opposition leader Nelson Chamisa of the Citizens Coalition for Change, or CCC party, will lock horns with President Emmerson Mnangagwa and his ZANU-PF party, along with other candidates for the presidency. Bridget Mabanda is one of the many young Zimbabweans who make up about three quarters of the country's population.
We want things to change as youth. As you can see, we are suffering from Zimbabwe. We are suffering. Everything is upside down. We are in potholes. Our money is not stable. And even our education, you can see from the fees that we are paying. It's not affordable to us as compared to what our parents are earning. We want a better Zimbabwe.
While actual figures of unemployment are hard to come by, Zimbabwe's informal sector has been mushrooming for the past two decades. 35-year-old Edmogu Chikauripo has never been employed. He wants that to change. He says the person he votes for must stop corruption and ensure that hospitals have medication and that their workers are paid fairly. He says the police should do their job and catch thieves. He also wants better care for children so that they do not turn to drugs and in turn can easily get jobs and take care of their parents. And jobs should be created. In the past year, Zimbabwe's annual inflation rate has shot up and is currently hovering at over 100%, one of the highest in the world, according to official figures. And many Zimbabweans are struggling to meet the cost of living, but not everyone is for change. 35-year-old Justin Gwanzu fondly remembers President Emmerson Mnangagwa's 2018 campaign. Power to Mnangagwa, that's what we want, he says. We want industries to be revived and jobs so that we can live a decent life. He says we want Emmerson Mnangagwa to continue as president so that we can work in companies and get payslips. Guan says that at 35 years, he has never received a payslip in his life. Alexander Rusero, a political analyst in Zimbabwe, says the pre-election period has been fairly peaceful compared with those of the past.
Yes, we have witnessed skirmishes here and there by some enthusiastic ZANU-PF party supporters against the CCC, but this is not a coordinated and systematic approach as was the case in the past.
As the country counts down to the polls, many Zimbabweans on both sides of the political divide hope that once the process is done, all will accept the results. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
That's all we prepared for you this Tuesday, August 22nd, 2023. When I leave you with Mawa and the song Beledi. We've been listening to Mawa and the song Beledi. Don't forget to visit voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you missed this program, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Killer William, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Nina
Lakin le, fienas nanin.